Hello, friends, and welcome to the Nugget Climbing Podcast. This is your host, Stephen Dimmitt, and my guest today is filmmaker Carlos Mason. I really enjoyed this conversation. This is a change of pace from the usual. Carlos is the creator of the new film, Sending, which is available at mountainhardware.com/sending. It's also available at sending.film. Be sure to check it out if you haven't seen it. This is a 20-minute film. It's absolutely beautiful. I was blown away when I saw it. It's really different from the average climbing film, and I was really excited to talk to the filmmaker, Carlos. So we go deep behind the scenes in this one and talk about his vision for the film and how that came to be, what inspired him to make it the way he made it, choosing the location and choosing the boulders, choosing the music, choosing the cast, and a lot more. We also talk about Carlos' background at the start of the interview, so I won't share that here. But a little bit more about the film before we dive in. Sending is a 20-minute film featuring three friends, Ethan Pringle, Dan Bell, and Anna Hazelnut, spending a weekend together in the Buttermilks in Bishop, California. I'm not getting anything for promoting this. I just really enjoyed the film, and Bishop has a very special place in my heart, as I'm sure it does for many of you listening. If you've been to Bishop, I think you will especially enjoy it. But regardless, be sure to check out the film and please enjoy Carlos Mason. All right, we're rolling. Carlos Mason, everybody. Welcome.
Hello, hello.
It's nice to meet you face to face over Zoom. Nice to see your face this time. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, man. I'm very happy to be here. I appreciate it.
I think we should start with some of your background. We're going to be talking about your very beautiful film. And I was a little bit late, actually, for this because I just finished watching it for the second time. I really enjoyed it so much. It's so beautiful and such a refreshing change of pace from all the other climbing films. There's so much content these days, but you've really done something unique here. I want to hear a little bit about your background as a climber and then your background as a filmmaker. Let's talk about those two things. So when and how did you get into climbing?
I got into climbing. So I was first introduced to climbing from my family. My uncle got me into climbing when I was four originally. So I was very young. He brought me bouldering out in Southern California, and I couldn't have had a better teacher to introduce me to it. You know, he was, you know, he's one of these guys that he grew up climbing in Yosemite back in the 70s. And he has he's experienced everything with climbing. So he was able to share it with me in a really special, insightful way. And that was when I started climbing, but I didn't really take climbing seriously until I was a little bit older, until I was like 12 or 13. And in like middle school, high school is when I really started climbing. But in that window of time, I would go to the climbing gym occasionally. I'd go outside occasionally, but it wasn't really a part of my life. But then in middle school, I was going to Vertical Hold, was my home gym in San Diego. And I connected with, again, like the most exceptional group of climbers I could have met to guide me along the way. I met up with Chris Lindner and Joel Rusher and our buddy Eric Harrison, who lived in San Diego at the time. And like, I don't know, I mean, those three, for an ambitious 12-year-old climber, I mean, you couldn't have like a better trio of teachers. You know, and they were all, I mean, Chris was the next youngest, and he was like 18 or 19. And the rest of them were like in their 20s and 30s. So I had really good teachers that would bring me out. They were, you know, they were going out into Bishop and Joshua Tree and Black Mountain, and they just started bringing me out. And my parents were stoked because the alternative was me, you know, sticking around town, just, you know, skateboarding, you know, trespassing on a private property to skate staircases and stuff. So they were like, oh, you're going to go out with a bunch of successful, great pro climbers. This is amazing. Right. So they were stoked. And, so yeah, I climbed, I did a lot of bouldering and sport climbing through high school. And then, I was confronted with the need to start working, you know, immediately and like start making money. I didn't go to college. I just went straight into doing freelance video production And at the time, you know, the production industry of within the outdoor space isn't the same as it was today. It wasn't, you know, like in all the years that I was climbing up until that point, I could tell you like maybe one or two times when I saw someone else with a camera out shooting, you know, like it wasn't like it is today where everyone's filming everything and like, you know, everyone's got YouTube channels and like making films. So it wasn't like that. So I didn't know how to shoot climbing and monetize it and make a career out of it. So I diverged into other avenues. I started doing commercial video production around Southern California. I was doing a lot of TV ads and then I, you know, I moved to LA in 2014 and then I just started my career there. But then I've continued climbing since, you know, consistently now for probably the last like 10 or 12 years, I've really been climbing without a break, except for the occasional. I mean, I get injured like everybody. So there's definite breaks, unwanted breaks, but yeah, that's my climbing.
Why is Bishop special to you? Of all the places you could have filmed this, you chose Bishop, which obviously it's stunning. It's one of the most visually inspiring places I've ever climbed. But it seems like you have a strong personal connection to Bishop.
I do. Yeah. I'm very aware of where I have good, happy, fun experiences, right? Like if you assess all the places that you've ever traveled, you know, you collect these experiences, and Bishop for me has just been, I mean, like I would be really challenged to list three really bad experiences I've had in Bishop, right? Like, I can't even think, but there's an unlimited amount of good experiences, right? Like I've had such a positive time out there. It's been such a inspiring and motivating place in my life. And, you know, it's where I, you know, when I go to the Buttermilks these days, it's like, I can reflect back on these really detailed memories with friends that mean a lot to me. And I also really respect the climbing there, right? Like the climbs there are world class for a reason. I mean, they're beautiful. They're tall, they're scary, they're hard. The rock quality's great. And it's fun. And then look, from a practical standpoint, it's just up the freeway for me. You know, when I grew up in San Diego, it was a 6-hour drive. Now I'm in LA, it's a 4-hour drive, give or take. So, you know, it's practical for someone in my position who I, you know, to be honest, I'm climbing on the weekends most of the time. You know, sometimes I have the opportunity where I can cut out for a week or two at a time, but I'm doing weekends. So, you know, Bishop fills that really well, which, you know, to compare it to Red Rocks is great. I love Red Rocks. It's amazing, but I just prefer being in the Sierras than being in Vegas. You know, like Vegas has, and I've done a lot of work in Vegas. I've done a lot of like commercial production work in Vegas. So when I'm in Vegas, when I look around, I'm like, oh yeah, I remember that job. That was stressful. You know what I mean? Like I have all these other experiences in Vegas that like make it not as fun of a place for me to spend time. And the Sierras is just, it's like you're going to a magic mountain town. It's like, I love it.
Totally. Yeah, I love that. I have I don't know if you know this, we might have talked about this when we talked on the phone a week ago, but Bishop was my first ever climbing trip. I was living in Bellingham going to school, and my friend Ruthie was like, do you want to go? I think I'd been climbing for a year and a half, and I was working at the climbing gym, so I think this was sophomore year winter. Winter break was coming up, you know, we're students. And Ruthie was like, do you want to go to Bishop for winter break? And I was like, what is a Bishop? You know what I mean? I'd never heard of it. What is it? Like, it wasn't like today. I mean, there was no online, this was 2008. There was no online anything for climbing, really, like no online video or anything. And it blew my mind. I mean, I think the hardest I climbed was V3 on that trip. I did like King Tut or something, and did some easy highballs and climbed in the Happies and in the Milks, and yeah, it just completely blew my mind. I didn't know that that's what climbing was, and I think, I mean, I was already pretty hooked just climbing in the gym, but that really like you know, sunk its hook into me and changed things for me, I think was really that trip. And subsequent trips too. It's such a special place. And it was everything. I love that you captured, I mean, this is what this film is about. Like for me, when I think of that trip, I can barely remember the climbing, but I can remember the 30-hour drive in Ruthie and Brandon's minivan, and we broke like two sets of chains, and the chains were like, we're going over, I can't remember the name of the pass, but like the pass in Southern Oregon, and it's snowy and shitty, and the chains are broken, and they're like whacking against the wheel well, you know, it's like, tutung, 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 and we were just in the back of the van, like, making up raps to this to the sound of the van getting destroyed, basically.
Exactly. Dude, there's so many experiences within climbing that have nothing to do with, you know, pulling your way through a hard sequence on the wall. And then that was a real inspiring aspect of the film for me, like was trying to tell that story. And how do you tell that story? Like how it was such an ambiguous kind of difficult aspect of our sport to incorporate into the story, you know, but it was a big part of the film for me, for sure. It was capturing what's between the climbs, you know, all these experiences between the climbs are just so, they're so beautiful and, you know, fun. It's a big part of it.
Yeah. You're already talking about this, but I wanted to ask you this. I mean, there are so many climbing films now, and there's very much a tried and true formula with a lot of them, you know, the same kind of story arc. It's a really engaging story arc. That's why it keeps getting repeated. You know, like a climber gets obsessed with a thing, they struggle, they get challenged, maybe they fail, they come back, maybe they have redemption and send it, maybe not, you know, but it's something along those lines. What did you want to create with this film?
Right. So it took me a while to succinctly recognize that this is what I wanted to do, but ultimately I wanted to make a fantasy climbing film. Like I wanted to make a narrative fantasy film about climbing. You know, like I wanted to create this world of fantasy that didn't include the documentary style of filmmaking where like the climber's engaging with the cameraman and like the camera is a part of it. And like, you know, that's a very common element of climbing videos. It's like the filmer, the camera's a part of the story. And I didn't want that. I was like, I wanted to create this world, this cinematic world where the camera doesn't exist. The audience, you know, the audience is, it's not it. Like we're intimately going into this story with this group of people and we're seeing this beautiful weekend in the Buttermilks, you know. I really wanted to capture what, like you were saying in 2008, what early, you know, the golden years of Bishop, right? Like the, you know, the early 2000s and the 90s of Bishop were like, where it was like, you could go there in January, New Year's weekend and like perfect temps. And there's like three cars at the birthdays. It's like, like crazy. Like, but that's what it was like back then. And it was so extraordinary that I wanted to try and wrap all that up into one film. You know, I wanted to show what it's like to be, when that place is empty of people and it's just you and a couple other people and you're experiencing the whole place just to yourselves. And it's not a documentary, you know, it's not, let me show you what I'm doing. It's like, that's cool. And I believe me, I find it just as entertaining as everybody, believe me, but that's just not what I wanted to do. And the thing about film, one of the things about filmmaking is it's really hard. It takes so much time and effort, and especially with a passion project, you know, where you're not making like a lot of money to do it. It's like, it takes so much. It's so draining. And if I was going to do it, I had to be really psyched on the way that I was doing it. Right. Like and that's what, you know, not to get too scrambled all over the place, but it's like, that's one of the reasons why it took me so long to make this happen, because for a long time, I didn't have that clarity of vision. And it wasn't until I had that clarity of vision that I had the motivation to get off my ass and I could actually make it happen. Sorry, I'm kind of rambling here, but
Well, let me double click on that. That's really interesting. Where did the clarity of your vision come from? Did it hit you, you know, in the shower one day, or had you been kind of trying to figure out what this film was?
So I can give you the idea. So originally, shortly after moving to LA in 2014, my very good friend and business partner at the time, who helped me with this film, Shelby Meinzer, I am hugely grateful for him helping me with this. But back in the day, he and I were business partners, and we wanted to make a spec commercial, an automotive spec commercial, right? A spec commercial is essentially you make a commercial that's an unofficial ad, and you use it to showcase your ability to make a legitimate car commercial to ad agencies. So you use it as like a tool to try to get jobs. We wanted to do this. And so we had this idea for, let's make like an outdoor focused, you know, climbing, ski, mountain biking car commercial. Right. And this, we had this whole idea and we wanted to do it. We were ambitious about it, but we didn't have the time or resources to do it because it was going to cost money. It was going to take time. And at the end of the day, what we were planning was a fake commercial, right? Like it wasn't like we weren't emotionally with it. We were strategically with it for business. We weren't in it emotionally, right? Well, that project, as much as we wanted to do it, got shelved for years. And then 2020 rolled around and it was quarantine. And I was, sitting in my apartment with a lot of time, and I realized, okay, let's like pick this back up. I picked it back up and I formalized it into a treatment. I wrote an actual treatment for the commercial. And after I'd made it into a treatment, which is like a PDF that like it explains in very, clear terms what the concept of the commercial would be, I realized, I was like, gosh, this is such a cool, beautiful story. I love this. Like, this is great. But it revealed to me that I didn't want to make a commercial. I was over it. Like, that's not, the value here, what I have is a short film to make. I don't have a commercial to make. Like, forget the commercial. I don't want to do it. I don't want to do that. I want to make a short film. And it, like, as soon as I thought, the light bulb, right? As soon as I thought about this project from that standpoint, it got really, really, really exciting really fast, because it was like, all the barriers that I had created in my own mind about why I couldn't move forward with they all disappeared, and it was just time to do it. It was like time to get to work. Like, we got to do this. Like, I have a short film. I'm impassioned. I'm stoked. Like, I know exactly what I want to do, and we're going to do it. So that's how it originally came about. This was going to be a car commercial, which, when you watch the film, cars and automotive travel like is a big part of this film. It still is. Like, that creative theme, that element carried through into the final story. And I was deliberate about that. I didn't want to, get rid of the cars and the trucks and the van, because like, those are a big part of climbing. Like, you're in your car, like you're in your van right now, dude. Like, this is like the vehicles that we take to go climbing are a major part of it. It's such a big part of it. If I'm going sport climbing in the Redwoods, I'm driving in my car for like an entire day, and I hope it doesn't break down, and I hope it works, and I hope, and it's, you know what I mean? Like, and like, I rely on it so much, and we all do. And then we sleep in it's like the cars and the vans and the trucks are just such a part of the whole thing. It's, so I wanted that to be a part of the story. I wanted to tell that because they're relevant, at least. And I like cars and trucks, and I think they're cool.
No, I love that. We talked about that on the phone a week ago, just the relationship that climbers have with their cars and how special and unique it is. And man, it's so true. Like, I had this 2000 Subaru Outback for several years before mm-hmm. I got the van, and it's just crazy what I put that thing through and the memories that I have. I mean, four dudes driving down to Bishop from Bellingham, sleeping in it, all right. Of our stuff's in there. Or like, I remember one year we went to Bishop for a week, and we had like 5 days of rain, in a week, and it was kind of heinous. And we put up our tent in kind of a divot on accident, and the tent got flooded, and like, me and my girlfriend just ended up sleeping somehow together in the back seat, just laid across the bench seat of the Subaru, you know, like I was like in the floor space, just sleeping on a pile of stuff and she was on the bench
seat.
You know, it's just, but that is such a part of, especially the early years of climbing when you're a broke college kid or whatever, just doing whatever it takes to get out there. And you were telling me about, you know, when you're in the Buttermilks and it's freezing cold, like the last thing you do before you go crawl into your freezing cold tent is just crank the heater in your car and sit there with the car running in the parking lot. And I'm like, oh man, every climber I know has done that. I love that.
Yeah. Dude, Dan and I will go climb. We'll go camping at the Milks. And like, sure enough, for like legitimately like an hour sometimes, like we're both essentially just parked next to each other in our cars and like all warm, like doing whatever for like an hour, you know, trying to figure out how to make brushing your teeth last that long. And, you know, enjoying it. But yeah, totally. I mean, the cars and the driving, you know, it's a big part of climbing for me. So I wanted that to be a part of the story. And it's an homage to what the original concept for the project was. You know, it was originally supposed to be a car commercial.
I love that. What a funny and unique spark for a climbing film, a car commercial, right? That turns into a beautiful narrative climbing film. I want to ask you about the narrative. Basically, for people that haven't seen the film yet, and I, you know, urge you to go watch it as soon as you finish listening to this. It's very music driven. I want to talk about the music later as well. But basically, the entire film is you doing a voiceover, reading basically a poem, a beautiful, heartfelt poem. And that's the entire narrative of the film. The only other sounds you hear, I think, from the climbers, from Ethan and Anna and Dan, I think the only thing you hear from them is Ethan's breathing in the final shot. And then, you know, the sound of the ocean at the beginning and the wind at the end. And how did the narrative come about? I mean, it's really beautiful. And some people have even reached out to you just asking for a copy of it so that they can print it out and kind of refer to it, which is so cool. And there's parts of it I want to read actually to chat about, but kind of introducing that, like, how did you write the narrative? Did you have that? Did you kind of envision that from the beginning and then it was just a matter of writing it and putting the pieces into play? How did that come about?
Yeah. So writing the script was actually probably the most difficult. I mean, aside from simply getting off my ass and deciding to get to work, that was the hardest part. The second hardest part was writing the script. I'm not a writer. I'm not a professional practice writer. I am a cinematographer though. So I, from the beginning, I was fundamentally seeing everything visually, as a cameraman. I was thinking about how I wanted to shoot it, what I wanted to see. I wasn't clear about the words and what the message was going to be until after I had already made significant progress in the edit. Mm. You know, when I was probably about 3/4 of the way through the edit, is when I started seeing what the film was turning into. And, you know, I'm watching it for hours back and forth, going back and cutting everything, and I'm figuring it out. And I started to identify the message that I wanted to tell, which is kind of a backwards way to work. You know, typically, in narrative film, your script is being written before you're shooting. It made a lot of sense for me because my initial inspiration was visual. And then after I was able to see the film is when I started finding the words. And I gotta also give a shout out here to, my good friend and also fellow producer on the film, Doug Riggs, good friend of mine, fellow filmmaker and film producer. He was directing his own film at the time. And, you know, he did something that really unlocked the script writing for me. He wrote a visual, his film was based on a visual poem. He was very clear about it. He's like, I'm writing a poem, I'm doing a VO, and I'm showing, and these are the scenes that I'm showing. And And it was like just seeing one of my fellow filmmakers, a friend who I respect greatly, just confidently just go, this is how it's going to be. This is what I'm going to do. I just realized, like, okay, that is a format that I can understand, that I can relate to, that I like. I don't need my characters on camera talking. I'm just going to do a VO, and it can be kind of abstract. It doesn't need to be super straightforward. It can be deeply honest and emotional, and that works. It makes sense. And then it's almost frustrating to me that I didn't click this together, because Terrence Malick is like one of my like all time favorite filmmakers, but if you watch Terrence Malick's movies, it's like, this is his style. This is what the guy does to a large degree. I mean, I don't know what his exact process is, but if you watch a Terrence Malick movie, like it's not a traditional narrative storytelling structure, right? And I've been watching his movies since I was a little kid. So like, it's like, oh, I can relate to how he makes movies. I directly witnessed and respected how Doug was making his movie. I was like, this is what I'm going to do. I have to write my own video. And, you know, so at that point I just buckled down and wrote it. You know, I sat down in Isla Kavanaugh's living room in Bishop and just with lots of coffee and just sat there and started writing. And then, you know, it took me a few weeks though to come out with what I finally made. And, there are multiple lines throughout the script that I know for sure go over some people's heads, or they just don't understand necessarily what I'm talking about. But it was the story that I had to tell. It was the message that I was down in my brain, and they're not so abstract that no one gets it. Like, you know, it's written for an audience that has experienced Bishop, and not to say that if you haven't been to Bishop, you're not going to, you know, necessarily appreciate or enjoy the film, but like, it's definitely written for people who have spent time in the Buttermilks for sure. Like the difference between the reception that I've received from people who have gone climbing the Milks for years versus people that haven't, it's like night and day. Like people that haven't been to the Buttermilks, like, oh, that's a great film, dude. It's cool. I really enjoyed it. People who have people like come to me after the film, like crying, like, this is amazing. Like, this is like so cool. So, you know, the writing was difficult for me, but I am proud of what I ultimately came out with. And I think just being really, really deeply honest about what I wanted to say and just finding the confidence to be vulnerable about it was paramount, because throughout the process, I was definitely thinking like, oh, like, no, like people won't get that. No, I can't say that. And I'm like, no, fuck that. No, I'm going to do that. Absolutely. This is exactly what I'm going to say, because this is what's in my heart and this is what I'm thinking. And if people don't get it, that's fine. Like, that's totally okay. It's acceptable. It's not like, not everyone needs to understand everything. This isn't a commercial. This is the thing. This is the freedom that I've given myself by deciding to make a narrative short film, is that it doesn't need to be perfectly understood by a mass market audience for broadcast. Like, that's not what it is. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? It's art, or at least, you know, it's what I was trying to do. So,
yeah, I love that. I'm going to read a section of it if that's okay.
Of course, please do. Yeah.
This is the very start of the narrative. This is, this is a little bit later, actually. This is maybe five or eight minutes into the film. This is a section called Mourning. And you write, sometimes morning gifts serendipity, rising to see who drove through the silence at 3 and who was here fast asleep before me. Sometimes it's strangers, but sometimes it's 20-year friends who you trust with your life and haven't seen in 3 seasons. Our cars may have changed, but where they take us is the same. It's like that trip around the world just happened. We've grown, but we still share the same passion. And I love that because you capture something magical about climbing that's a byproduct of climbing, and it's mysterious. And I've experienced it so many times in 15 years that I've been climbing. It always amazes me. There are literally millions of people who climb in the United States alone, but somehow when you go on a spontaneous trip to Bishop or anywhere, any climbing destination, you know, you get rained out in the redwoods or something, and you go to Bishop because the forecast looks amazing. all of a sudden it feels like the climbing community is 200 people. You know, it's like, how yeah. could I have possibly happened to like park right next to this old friend of mine who I met in 2012 in Squamish, you know, like it's been 10 yeah. years. I haven't seen them, but I just rolled in the middle of the night and parked here and I wake up and like, oh, it's you, you know, and it happens all the time. It happens way too often. It makes no yeah. sense.
It totally. Yeah. That was an interesting section to write because I knew that I wanted, so there's a scene that part of the script is read during a one take shot that shows our group, our cast waking up, you know, Ethan, Anna and Dan, they're all waking up together and they're in the same campground. And it's a oneer. The shot is a oneer, meaning it's one continuous shot. And I wanted the voiceover to last through that shot. And so it was, yeah, I had a very specific time frame to work with. And I had a lot that I wanted to say about the whole experience that you're talking about. I'm not a professional practice writer, but I do take a lot of pleasure in finding, you know, fun ways to play with words together and how they sound. You know, I enjoy that. And I kind of just found my way into writing this part in a way that the words sound good together the way that I wrote them. I think, you know, I'm really critical of most of my work, but I am proud of how I wrote that. And it's true, you know, when you're out climbing, you run into people in the most serendipitous ways. Sometimes it's, you know, it can feel so random. You don't plan it, but you run into these friends that you've had for a long time, or sometimes you don't. Sometimes you wake up and you're, you know, some, you know, big loud truck pulled up in the middle of the night and you're wondering like, oh, who's that? And you wake up and it's like, I have no idea who it is. And maybe you have a new friend, or maybe it's someone who like woke up at sunrise and they're gone. You never even see them. They're parked right next to you and you have no idea where they are and they're not there. You know what I mean? Like, and, but anyways, for sending, what I wanted to tell was essentially the idea that three friends, you know, serendipitously were at the same place at the same time and got to connect and, oh, what's up? Like, I haven't seen you. And, you know, yeah. Like you're saying, we went to Squamish together like 3 years ago. Like, dude, it's great to see you. You know, those are the types of rendezvous that happen in climbing. And I wanted to show that. And again, there's a, you know, there's an homage to the time, you know, 20 year friends, right? Like, I mean, I still have friendships with people from when I was a kid through climbing, you know, and I hope to have those friendships the rest of my life. And trusting, this is one thing that was, I was happy I figured out how to include this. It's interesting to me how your climbing friends tend to be people who you trust with your life, like legitimately, like you know, when you climb with people, you trust them with your life. Now, could you say the same thing about all the people you work with? Mm. Not necessarily. Like, I work with a lot of people who are great people. They're really responsible. They're awesome. I love working with them. If we were out on a multi-day trek and I like fell and sprained broke my ankle and I couldn't walk, I don't know if I would have trust and belief that they would be able to like run and get help and save me. Right. But my climbing friends, dude, they're ready to go. Like, I trust my climbing friends are like soldiers, dude. Like, they are like capable people and I mm-hmm. believe in them and trust them. And like, you know, that's something that I wanted to convey. It's like, you can have these friendships with people, and the common denominator being climbing is just, it instills this level of trust that's to the point of absolute survival. And I think that's really cool. You know, our cars may have changed, but where they take us is the same. That's, you know, a reference back to what we were talking about earlier with my admiration for the driving and vehicles of climbing. You know, we get new cars, but they still take us to the same spot. I'm not driving my wind cart of a Prius that's breaking down. I might've gotten a new Subaru, but it's bringing me to the same exact spot, mm-hmm. you know, it's the same thing. And then, you know, I talk about how we've grown, but we still share the same passion. It's, you know, it's the same thing. Like, you know, I first climbed with Dan and Ethan separately, but when we were like teenagers, you know, that was when I first met those guys. And it's like, we've grown, like we're, you know, we make jokes now about how we're like old and injured, you know, we're like, and we're on the dark side now, you know, but we still have the same passion for climbing and it's still there. So yeah, that was a challenging, but really fun. That was probably one of my most, fun parts of the script to write, I think.
I always find it fascinating when I meet or when I re-meet people, you know, run into people who I've known for a long time through climbing. I always have two simultaneous thoughts and they're, you know, they're total, it's a total paradox, but one of them is, oh, wow, you're still climbing. Like, how about that? That's amazing. You know, like, what are the odds? And then the other thought is like, well, of course you're still climbing. Like, there's, you know, how could you ever not? And yeah. But it's fascinating. It's like, oh, wow, you're still doing this. You're still coming to these same places. You're just like me. How about that? Fascinating. You right. know?
Yeah, totally. It's a lifelong thing, man. I mean, I've had injuries that, you know, when you get a debilitating injury of some kind that disables you from climbing, it's like, you know, it's easy to allow invasive thoughts to take over and you're wondering like, ah, am I like gonna continue doing this? And then it lasts for such a brief amount of time. I'm like, absolutely, fuck yeah. Are you kidding me? Yes, like I'm not gonna stop climbing. My retirement plan is climbing. Climb till the end. Like there's no, you know, and if it gets to the point where all I can do is hike up a trail, well then that's my climbing. You know what I mean? Like, yeah, it's a lifelong, long-term thing for me, for sure. I can relate to that.
How did you choose the cast for this film? I love and something that's so unique about this film is that you are telling your story, speaking your truth, or just like telling the story of climbers, but through these three other people. I think that's really beautiful. Yeah. And it's Ethan Pringle. He's a good friend of mine. And Dan Bell, who I have met and had some great conversations with, but have not interviewed on the podcast yet. And then Anna Hazelnut, who I've interviewed, but haven't met in real life. But three people that I love and admire. And I think they're all such wonderful people. Yeah. How did you choose the cast? How did that come together?
Well, so, I mean, Dan and I have been wanting to shoot stuff together for forever, just because we've been climbing partners and going on trips together forever. And, you know, I've been firsthand witnessing him being one of the strongest climbers I can imagine. And he's been witnessing me, you know, pursuing my career in film production. Ethan and I have been friends for a long time, and you know, Ethan's schedule's crazy. Like Ethan's constantly moving. He's doing stuff. He's constantly on another climbing trip. He's shooting stuff left and right. I always wanted to shoot Ethan just because I'm like, too, like I look like Ethan's like one of the superstars for climbing to me. You know, like when I started climbing, Chris Leonard, you know, introduced me to Ethan and I was like, holy fuck, dude, like I'm climbing with Chris and Ethan right now. Like, what, these dudes, these are the best climbers on the planet. Like it was so fun. So, you know, it's easy to understand why I'd want to shoot with Ethan. And then Anna is someone who I met most recently, right? Like I've known Dan and Ethan forever. I met Anna not long before we shot. But she's like Anna's like so many people you meet in climbing, like she's such a good person. She's so good at climbing, and I respect her as a climber. I respect how she climbs, right? Like in my, you know, I make jokes about how I'm like getting older as in my old age. Like I'm critical about climbing now. Like I really judge style and precision and balance and technique. Like if someone climbs V12 in front of me and their footwork sucks, like I'm not impressed by that. I'm sorry. I don't care. Like, but someone that climbs a V3 and does it perfectly and I respect that a lot. Right. And she's got good technique. I mean, she just did, To Bolt or Not to Be. We just shot her doing To Bolt or Not to Be.
Oh, you did. And nice.
That was so sick. So on, you know, despite not knowing her for years and years and years, like in the short time that I knew her, like I very promptly realized like, wow, I respect her a lot. And I, you know, she's someone that I, would love to have be a part of this story. And, so I admired all of them. I respected all of them. And I wanted the film. The film is very personal and honest, and it's my passion project. So I didn't want the casting to just be like the result of haphazard, you know, convenience. I didn't want it to just be random people. I wanted it to be people who I had a connection with, who I cared about, who I had shared some of these experiences with, actually, you know. And you know, that decision ended up ultimately benefiting the film, because, you know, like that line in the script, you know, sometimes it's 20 year friends you trust your life. Like, I don't think I would have come up with that line if I wasn't watching Ethan and Dan walking up to each other, hugging on camera. Like, that, watching that is what like allowed me to come up with that, you know. And that, you know, so it was just really important to me that every element of this project within my control be authentic and true and part of my actual climbing story, you know? And there were, I will say this, you know, there were other iterations of this film that I had in mind that included other scenes with additional other climbers. You know, it ultimately didn't come to be, and like what we made is what we made. And I'm very happy with what it ended up being, but there were other climbers that I wanted to try to feature in this as well. And, you know, maybe that'll happen in the future, but like, you know, I do think that shooting with the three of them ended up making the most sense because it kept it intimate. You know, character development is something that's really difficult, especially in a film like mine that doesn't, you know, it's kind of, the characters were kind of abstract. They're not really explained who they are. I didn't really explain who they are anyways. So I had a very limited amount of time to introduce each character, right? So if I threw like 4, 5, 6 people in, all of a sudden, there would be all these people, right? So I decided I didn't want more than like 3 people for the majority of the film. And they were the right people for it. And then at the end, so at the end of the film, there's a campfire scene that symbolizes the, you know, the group dynamic of friendship with more, you know, the climbing community really at large. And even that group came together from my longtime friend, Isla Kavanaugh, who, you know, Isla and I first met climbing out of San Diego when we were kids. Actually, I think I've known Isla probably longer than Dan and Ethan, you know? So even though that group in the film, they weren't prominent characters, they were still important friends and connection, right? Like they weren't just random people. Like they were, it's still Isla, who I went to Phoenix bouldering contests with when we were 12, right? Like I like, you know, so like for me, that's important because when I watch that scene, I don't care if anybody else likes it. I watch that scene and to me, I'm like, oh, look at this wonderful group of my life friends that I've put together. Like, this is amazing, right? Like, so I wanted the cast to be a group of people who would help me love my own film. You know,
that's great.
You know, because that's another thing. Like, I mean, I do a lot of work. I do a lot of commercial work where, you know, I don't have any personal connection to the talent or the models or actors or actresses that I'm working with. Right. And that's fine. You don't need a personal connection with everybody, but when you do have a personal connection with the people you're shooting, it makes it a more rewarding experience as a filmmaker, in my opinion, in my experience at least.
And we will be right back. This episode is brought to you by Tyndek. I've talked about this thing a lot on the show because I'm a huge fan. The Tyndek Progressor might be the most useful training tool I own. I've had mine for a little over a year now. I use it at the gym. I use it in my van. I use it at the crag. I use this thing all the time, and it's super duper handy. What is it? The Tyndek Progressor is a digital force gauge that you can sync to your phone with Bluetooth to measure your finger strength. You can use it for all sorts of other exercises too. This thing looks like a little block with a couple holes in it. You can attach it to a tension block All you need is some type of hangboard, a couple carabiners, a sling, and your tin deck, and you can do legit finger training anywhere. It pairs with your phone and gives you a live readout of how much load you're pulling with your fingers, so you can do max hangs or recruitment pulls or whatever you want to do literally anywhere. I flew my tin deck to Magic Wood and Rocklands last summer. It's really small. It weighs almost nothing, so it was no big deal. And I did all of my training with a tension block, a sling, and my tin deck all summer. And I set an all-time finger strength PR a few months into the trip, just from doing a few hard pulls before I went climbing a couple days a week. I've talked about this thing a lot with Tyler Nelson. He's a huge fan of this thing. He's the one who introduced me to it. There's lots of ways you can use it. It's awesome. Go to tindeck.com to check out their products. I have the Progressor 300, but the 200 is more than enough capacity for finger training. And use code NUGGET to save $10 off anything in their shop. That's tindeck.com, T-I-N-D-E-Q.com. And use code NUGGET at checkout to save $10 off your order. Train your fingers anywhere with Tindeck. This episode is brought to you by Crimpt. If you are psyched to level up your climbing in 2024, check out the Crimpt app. This is the most useful app I've seen when it comes to self-coached training for rock climbing. Crimpt has dozens of workouts that focus on all the different facets of climbing performance and training, strength, endurance, power, flexibility, you name it. You can find workouts for whatever you want to train, and they have been carefully crafted by world-class climbers and coaches. I did a really fun collaboration with Crimpt last year, and one of their featured playlists is a selection of workouts that I made for those of you who prefer to train on real rock. Emil Abrahamson also has a playlist to help you guys address common skill and strength gaps on the journey from V0 to V15. And Ryan Devlin over at the Struggle Podcast, who's a friend of the show, has a playlist for pumpy overhanging sport climbing as he chases his first 513 at the Red River Gorge. So you can find all of that and a lot more in the app. It really is a treasure trove of training information, and it will guide you every step of the way. So check out Crimpt. You can learn more and download the app by going to crimpt.com. That's C-R-I-M-P-D.com to get started and download the Crimpt app for free. And now back to the show. And how did you choose the climbs that were featured in the film? Because that dictates the whole feeling, the cinematography, a lot, right? So much. And I mean, a couple of my favorite shots in the film are directly because of the climbs that you chose. Like, I'll share a couple. The first one is when Ethan does the bat hang on Luminance, and it sounds like that was completely unplanned, but of course he did it. You know, how could he not? Just classic Ethan. But, you know, he's bat hanging above like a death landing, and there's this quick shot to Anna and her just covering her eyes like she can't watch him do this. I loved that like little moment where you just feel, as a viewer, you feel like you're right there on the ground next to Anna watching Ethan do this from below and just kind of having your mind blown. And it's great. I just love that moment. And, you know, that moment wouldn't have happened if you hadn't chosen Luminance. So how did you how did you choose the climbs for this film?
The climbs there were two main things I wanted to achieve with the specific climbs. I wanted them to be, first and foremost, picturesque. I wanted to shoot climbs that showed the Sierras and the environment and the location, right? Like, the location of the Buttermilks is a part of the story, more so than, you know, oh, this crimp is 7 millimeters and you've got to grab it like this. If you don't grab it like that, it doesn't work. I don't care about that. The story is in the Buttermilks, in the space, and the mountains in the background, and the way the light comes in, and the way that, you know, and, you know, like, that was such a major part of the story. So I wanted to find climbs that we could shoot in a beautiful way. And I also wanted to shoot climbs that I was familiar with, that I had experienced, whether they be projects of mine or things that I had already done. I wanted to know them. And that's partly just you know, me wanting to shoot stuff that I know, but it's also, that was also a practical thing because, you know, I'm imagining like, okay, how am I going to shoot this? Where am I going to shoot from? Like I'm sitting in my apartment, imagining where am I going to shoot from? It's a lot easier to imagine how you're going to shoot something that you've climbed before because you know to climb, as opposed to like, oh, I have no idea about that boulder. I have no idea where I'm going to shoot from. Right. So, Ethan helped me a lot with choosing the climbs. You know, I gave him a list and, you know, we kind of went back and forth on the list and talked about what made sense and what would be cool. And then we also thought about what would, play well together in terms of trying to show a realistic climbing weekend. Right. Like that was one thing I wanted to show climbs in a sequence that's kind of realistic for how a climbing weekend goes. Right. Like, you know, it's not like, you know, a regular climbing weekend isn't going to be, we're doing five V12s back to back. Like that's, I mean, that can happen, but like, come on. Right. So, but what's a more realistic thing? Well, the crew might go to Luminance and then, okay, well, when you're coming back from Luminance, what, you know, let's head back to the birthday. So like, let's stop by East Side Story. Cause you know, that's where you would go and great. Okay. And then, you know, what are you going to do after that? Like I wanted it to flow the way that a climbing weekend flowed. I didn't, you know, that was like kind of the idea. And like, you know, well, we're chilling at the van. Let's eat lunch. Where are we going to chill? Well, we just finished East Side Story. We're going to be sitting in the parking lot at the birthdays. Like that's where we're going to be. Right. And I wanted it all to work and all to make sense. And if you watch the film with a critical eye for that, for thinking about how climbing trips actually go, you'll see that I tried to really make it realistic. Right. And towards the end, it's like, okay, it's Sunday morning. It's like, you know, the crew's been climbing kind of hard. You know, it's like, okay, well, Southwest Arete in the morning, like it's a thing that you do. Like, you know, this is a thing you do. You climb Southwest Arete in the morning. And then it's like, okay, well, like the final project, my skin's gone. Like I've got, you know, no more days in Bishop after this. Like I've got to go try my project. I've got to go do the one that like counts. Right. Like, and that's where we ended up. On this side of paradise at the end. So a lot went into it and I'm happy with what we ended up shooting. I mean, the bat hang on Luminance was totally nuts and I was happy that, you know, part of what I wanted to show in that was one, how intimidating and crazy it is that he did that, but also how playful and casual and chill it was too, right? Like, cause one thing that kind of bugs me about climbing, I mean, look, soloing and all this stuff, it's super impressive. It's badass, but it's created this impression of climbing that climbing is like all about just like ultimate risk, danger. Like, I mean, come on. Like that's not what it's about for most people. Most people aren't out there like trying to like risk their life on, you know, the week before Christmas. You know what I mean? Like, and so with Ethan doing the bat hang, as crazy as that was, showing Anna being like, you fucking nut, what are you doing? Like, this is crazy. It's like, that's it. It's fun. It's like, yeah, he's doing something super sketch, but like, he's not, it's playful. It's fun. It's not this intense life or death thing. It's fun. It's fun still, right? Like that's what it's about. So that's what I wanted to achieve in that little moment, right? Like and that was an insert shot. Like I went in after the climb and I was like, okay, Anna, like I did direct that. I directed that in. I was like, you got to give me a reaction for being surprised about him bat hanging Luminance. So that was an insert shot that I captured, but I think it told that part of the story, the playfulness of it.
Yeah, I love it. That's great. What was the dialogue or the banter on the ground in real life, in real time when he was doing that?
I mean, I don't think there was like your actual sentences of banter being made. I think everyone was like, oh my God, Jesus Christ. Okay. Wow. You know, I was like, I mean, I definitely had a moment where I was, I mean, first of all, I'm like filming. And if you notice on that shot, specifically, like I'm doing a very subtle continuous camera move. And so like for that shot, I was dialed in. Like I was like, cause I wanted it to be like this very subtle, constant moving move, like throughout the whole climb was my goal. Right. So, you know, I was locked in and like tripping. I was like, oh my God, I hope he doesn't fall. This is nuts. Okay. Get the camera right. Perfect. Tilt up correctly. Don't pan. Slow down. Okay. Like I was like, I was so dialed in. I wasn't like talking. I was like stressed and in the moment, but yeah, everyone was pretty like surprised and impressed. And then he did it twice. So then it was just like, all right, you're put down.
yeah, of course he did. I love it. I'm going to share another favorite shot from the film because I have a couple questions about it. So another part that really stood out to me that I loved, both in the visual and in that part of the script, that part of the narrative, is Dan running through the beta in his head for the process. And you can barely even tell where he is. You never showed the full climb. He's just standing below the process, looking up at it, running through the moves in his head and pantomiming them with his hands and arms and stuff. And, you know, then he's massaging his hurt finger and you're saying, commitment through time is a test and I choose to believe this one's worth my perseverance. And that whole shot, that whole scene is just such a beautiful window into the climber's psyche. It just captures so many elements of it. Our obsession with projects that go on for years and years and the emotional roller coaster that we ride when we haven't done it yet, but we think we can. And maybe we've got a finger injury or like a little nagging, you know, something tweak or whatever that we're kind of being patient through. And we're still just going back to the boulder and standing below it and looking at it and feeling some of the holds and running through the beta in our heads, just kind of staying engaged in that process. How did you decide to put that in the film?
Well, I wanted going back to the very first iteration of the concept when it was still going to be a commercial, I wanted, and this wouldn't have been appropriate for the commercial, but I wanted to show pain and struggle. I wanted to show convey pain and struggle with a sense of actual gravity. Like I didn't want it to be like, oh, I got a flapper. Like, oh, dude, damn. Like, fuck. Like, that's that. It's like, no. Like, let's be honest here. Like, let's actually dive into the dark place that you can go to after years of trying something where like you're actually like really like trying and you're trying to figure this out and it's not working. And like, and it's, you know, your hand hurts and you're mentally like in this, you're in your head, like, I wanted to convey the gravity of it and the intensity of it, you know. And I mean, Dan in the process, dude, I mean, that's a story. I mean, dude, he's put more work into that climb. I mean, I can't tell you how many times I've seen him do every single move of that climb. And then for him to, you know, get stopped by essentially like exploding his shoulder and like going through like the subsequent injuries that he's had to deal with over the last few years. Like that's the best example of wanting to try to convey pain and struggle of climbing and commitment that I could possibly have imagined. Right. And so like, that was just a really honest look into the experience. There was no bullshit there. That was real. There was, you know, I didn't have to direct too much there. It was just, it was real. Like, you know, he's trying something that's, you know, he's been trying it for like over a decade and he knows every move. And, you know, and I use his experience to represent my experiences that I've had and that I think that other climbers have had, you know, when you know every move and you know, like you've felt every move the way that it feels right. And you've felt every move when it feels wrong. So, in, you know, you feel like, you know, exactly how it's supposed to pull together. And yet somehow, some way you just still can't do it. And it's like, and then of course, it's like, all right, now that I figured everything out, my hand is just gone. I can't use this hand. Like, may as well put it behind my back, and I'm Captain Hook trying to get my way up. You know what I mean? And it's like, it's just such a, climbing can be so soul crushing, especially like at that level, you know, when you're trying stuff that difficult. I mean, gosh, dude, like I can't even imagine. So I don't know, I'm going into a tangent, but yeah, like I wanted to show like the gravity of the struggle of staying committed through time on a climb. You know, it's hard, and, you know, and trying to assess when it makes sense to move on and just go to another thing, right? Because it's, you know, there's a certain point where it's like, okay, like, let's just try something else. Or are we going to commit the next season to trying to do this again? You know what I mean? It's, and, you know, I'm really grateful that Dan allowed me to show that, because, you know, as much as this film is an honest look into my own experience in my own life, like, that was for sure the most vulnerable moment of reality for another person in the film. Like, you know, like that was Dan. That was like, that was a, you know, you know, that was a true moment for what, you know, he's experienced in his own climbing over the last, you know, few years. So, and you know, the way that that section in the film moves on, and, you know, I, you know, we then transition into another aerial shot that I'm really proud of that shows him topping out the slab on the back of the Peabody boulder. And that, I shot that totally separately from Sending, even before we started shooting Sending. And I wanted to, you know, some people have said, oh, the light doesn't match in that. He's wearing a different thing. And I'm like, yeah, it's not meant. Continuity was deliberately disregarded there. That's not meant. That shot wasn't meant to show, be continuous. That shot was meant to convey the seasons, the passing of the seasons, the continued effort. It's like, here we go. Here's a V16 climber who's the strongest dude I've ever seen. And at this point in time, he can do the V0 slab on the back. Mm. Like, that's where he's at in that moment, right? Like, frustration, patience, geez. Like, there's gravity there. So anyways, that was my headspace for wanting to write and direct that scene.
I love it. Yeah, you really, I had this feeling. I mean, I know a lot of Dan's story. I've had some long conversations about the stuff he's been through in the last few years with his health struggles and injuries and things along those lines. And so, you know, maybe a lot of my listeners won't have that kind of context, but I like that in the film you can see exact, it's like such an accurate and honest snapshot of where he's at. I mean, with everything you're talking about with the process, but also he's like feeding Ethan Beta on everything because he's that guy. He's done everything so many times. Yeah. He knows all of these climbs intimately and he can feed everyone Beta, but it's almost like his life is on hold. You know, he's just stuck on this project and has just been going up and down with the injuries. And so there's very little footage of him actually climbing in the film. And I was just like, oh, wow, that's a really honest representation of this snapshot in time with where Dan's at. Yeah,
totally. I mean, on one hand, it's like, you know, Dan's like one of my closest longtime friends, climbing friends for sure. And you know, it's like, I would have liked nothing more than for, you know, Dan to be, uninjured at the time we were shooting, but the reality is he was, you know, and it is what it is. It's true. I mean, he's the guidebook now and he knows Dan is, his ability to accurately give Beta, I mean, dude, he's it's incredibly impressive how good he is at memorizing and remembering things. It's nuts. He remembers Beta for every single thing, 100% in the buttermilks without question. And I guarantee you, despite definitely not going to the happies or the other areas as much as buttermilks, like, he knows those other climbs too. Like, he knows everything, dude. He knows he knows the moves to everything he's done in such an impressive way. And yeah, and you see that in the film. Like, he's giving beta. He knows it for sure.
Mm-hmm. I love it. Let's talk about the music. I mean, that's such a, the first time I watched the film before even talking to you, that really stood out to me. Just how prominent a role the music plays in this film. And I found myself wondering, how the hell did you decide on the music? And I'm really curious to hear what that process was like, because for me, I have a background in music and I really love music. I appreciate what it can do, how powerful it is for storytelling and for, you know, emotions. And I mean, when I had to choose the theme music for the podcast, that was like, you know, a month-long, multi-month-long process. There's so much music out there. I was just like browsing on a royalty-free site, you know, browsing for options. And it's so overwhelming. And if you'd chosen anything different than what you had chosen, it would have made it, you know, it would have completely changed the film. So what was that process like? How did you choose the music?
Yeah, the music in the film is major. Like, there's no question. Like, I, you know, the Field Tapes and Hammock are two groups that that I found just searching for stuff that I liked online. And I found them. And yeah, I mean, for as proud as I am of the cinematography that we achieved and everything else, like, without the music, this would not be the film that it is. So I am very grateful and stoked for being able to use that soundtrack. I wanted to make a fantasy movie, right? Like, that's what I want. I wanted to make a climbing fantasy narrative, right? And so I wanted instrumental tracks that were just really intense and beautiful and warm and like romantic and also, okay. And another thing about Sending is I made Sending to be seen in a movie theater. I did not make Sending to be seen on the internet or on a phone. And I knew that I was going to have my festival run and that was it, right? Like, then it's not going to be seen in theaters anymore. But like, I made Sending to be seen in a movie theater. That was a thing. I was like, I want the decisions for how I make this movie to be guided by the ultimate placement of my film in a theater. And knowing that, I wanted a soundtrack that would just be intense in a movie theater. Intense. Like, I wanted the music to just be like borderline too much, right? Like, I was really inspired by, again, like, if you, Terrence Malick, if you really explore the soundtracks of his films, and then
what are some examples?
And then Chris Nolan's movies, right? Like, sound, like the sound in Chris Nolan's movies is just, it's like, it's arresting and just brutal and so stress inducing and like, oh God, it's like such a major successful part of how he tells stories. And I wanted to achieve that. I wanted to try to replicate that same type of emotional impact through the music. And I did the same thing as you do. That took me months. It took me a long time to find those tracks. Like, it took me a long time, but I found them. And then when I found them, I had them in a playlist and I would listen to them on repeat for hours. I would drive. I mean, I remember multiple drives out to Bishop where I listened to the same five or six songs on repeat for the entire 4-hour drive to Bishop, like just like drilling it into my imagination and envisioning scenes and like how perfect it would play. And like, you know, it was a big part of it. I couldn't give you references to the titles of other tracks from other films, but I mean, I referenced, you know, Terrence Malick's soundtracks and, you know, in Thin Red Line and, you know, in Tree of Life and, Knight of Cups. Yes. And then, you know, everything that Chris Nolan does, like the soundtrack is just, it's just beautifully brutal and perfect, you know? And so anyways, that was the headspace I was in when I was trying to figure out music and I was trying to think, and I wanted it to be different. I wanted it to be different. You know, I didn't want the soundtrack to be something that people expected. I wanted it to be something unique that would distinguish itself from other soundtracks.
Yeah. You've certainly done that. Yeah, you've certainly done that. I can't think of any other climbing film that uses the same genre or world of music. You know, it's all these days, it's all like hip hop, which is awesome. You know, it pumps you up, gets you psyched. But
Part of it for me too was, you know, okay, I knew this going into it, but it really became an imperative point for me once I had the film in the timeline and I was editing. Because when it's in the timeline, there's a visual thing for every clip and sound effect and everything is visually in front of you, right? And I made a point to myself when I started the edit where I was like, there's not going to be a single thing in this timeline that's not important. Mm. Like if it's not important, it's fucking gone. Like I'm over it. Gone. Not gonna do it. Like it need every single sound effect, clip, transition, everything that I see in this timeline needs to add something that I am emotionally motivated by, right? Like, and that's where I was at. And so I imagine, like, you know, if I put like a song with lyrics, there's going to be lyrics that don't align with, you know what I mean? Like, you know, I might be inspired by a moment of the song with lyrics, but there's going to be lyrics in my film that don't have anything to do with my film. Mm-hmm. Like, that just can't be. It cannot be. Like that's not where this is at, right? It has to be important. And so these songs, they, you know, every moment of each song supported the story. And I was stoked on that. And I, you know what? I'll actually, let me, you know, this is a cool story and I'll, you know, I'll try to be quick with it. But I had my first experience meeting Chris Sharma was at one of the outdoor retailer trade shows back in, like, dude, this must have been like 2005 or six or something. And I was, you know, very like awestruck to like meet Chris Sharma, right? And like, I was making climbing videos at the time and I don't know why I asked him this. I don't know why this is what I asked him, but this is what I asked him. I asked, this was right after King Lines, right? This is when King Lines came out. And I was like, how do you guys decide on them? I asked him the same question. How do you guys decide on what music to use in a climbing video? And Chris, you know, he's like, well, you just gotta go with what feels right. And I was like, you know, in my adolescent like mind, I'm like, okay, dude, right, all right. Go with what feels right. Okay, got it. And now I'm thinking like, what is that stupid question to ask Christian or whatever. Point being, fast forward to our situation now, right? Like I'm toiling over what music to use. I swear that like I got brought back to that moment and I realized, I was like, I'm such an arrogant fool for disregarding that piece of advice that he gave me, because yeah, like these are the songs that feel right. They
that,
feel
that really right. Is all it is.
That's it. I don't care if you know, if it's not going to appeal to a certain audience. I don't care if some people are going to, it's too loud. I don't care about any of that. Like, I don't care if it feels right to me. It's the right thing for my film. And it like, dude, I mean, talk about a 20 year, like, you know, process of taking appreciation for advice from the climber of our time, right? Like, you know, I was silly and short-sighted about it for a while, but Sharma gave me some really, really helpful advice. And like, once I remembered that, I was like, oh, I'm picking these songs because Sharma told me to do it at this point. Like that equates to him telling me to use these songs. Right. Mm-hmm. So that was just a story that like, I kind of remembered while I was in front of my computer listening and like, that was dope advice. That was actually like much more insightful than I kind of gave it credit for at first. So yeah, that was cool.
That's great. You're talking about sitting in front of your computer editing. You know, I edit my own podcast. I know how much time that takes to simply clean up a conversation that I'm planning to share with people on the internet. I can't imagine editing films, you know, at the scale that you are creating films. I've done funny little vlog style things, but that's it. Mm-hmm. How much time, how much money, how much effort does it take to make a film like this?
I mean, gosh, dude. I mean, I gotta be honest. You know, hindsight's 20/20. Now moving forward, I next film I make is gonna be, I think, well, I imagine that I'll be much more efficient in the process. You know, I took a long time to make this film. And that being said, this was part of the beauty of this project for me is I was like, I don't have a client. I don't have people telling me I have no deadline. I'm making this, I'm taking the time to make this the way that I want to make it. It took me months. I was editing for months and, you know, I edited entire scenes that I ultimately had to can. And I took a while to do it, you know, and I went through the whole phase of, you know, starting an edit. It's like starting a paper when you're writing a paper, right? It's so hard to start an edit, especially as the cinematographer, because you're also like looking with a magnifying glass on your own work, your own shots. So you take off the cinematographer hat, you put on the editor hat and you're looking at it. You're going, why'd you pan? Why'd you pan? What were you doing? Why didn't you use a tripod? You know, so it can be a very, like, for me at least, it could be a very, editing my own stuff can be a very like stress inducing, frustrating process because I'm being an editor can conflict with being a cinematographer. You know, it just can, like, you know, the priorities of the editorial can be different than the priorities of the cinematographer. And so for me, I can, you know, it was inefficient because I kept going back and forth about certain things. Oh, I like this shot, so it needs to be in. And then I'm like, oh, but it doesn't make sense time-wise, so I need to take it out. So it took me months to edit. You know, the editing, I did it all myself, so it didn't cost me money, but it, well, that's a lie. The edit, actually, I'll tell you why. Well, the editing didn't cost me money, but once I moved into color, there was part of me, I was going to, at one point in time, I was like, all right, I'm going to just, this is a really important project, whatever it costs, I'm just going to go to company 3 and get it colored by one of the best colorists in the world. And this is going to be great. And then I, like, you know, came to terms with the fact that, like, I actually could not afford to do that. That was not going to work. And that was beyond budget. But so,
how much would that have cost?
$5,000 to $10,000 minimum, probably, after, like, you know, leaning on the fact that I've worked, you know, we got another commercial coming down and it's whatever. But like, point being, I decided that I was going to color it myself. And at that point I realized, well, my computer's not fast enough to color this myself. I need a better computer. All right. So that was I bought a brand new MacBook Pro, just whatever, $5,000 or $6,000, so that I could color it myself, because coloring, you know, you can do the edit with, you know, proxies, it could move fast, but like, once you're coloring and adding filters and, you know, film emulation and stabilization, like, that starts to take a lot of processing power. So I need to buy a new computer. Yeah, I feel like I'm rambling again, dude. I'm sorry, but
that's okay.
The post-production, I mean, I did almost all the post-production myself, and it was, it took months. I mean, I think, let's see. Okay. So I started editing and I was in post for like 6 months.
Wow.
I was in post for like 6 months. And then the sound, I'm not a sound mixer. So like that was one whole, after finishing color and everything visual, then it was like, okay, let's just put on some headphones and like actually mix this thing and like get the levels between my VO and the, let's get it all correct. And that was a learning experience because I'm not a sound mixer, dude. I had to figure that out. And granted, I had to help my friend Gia, who recorded my voiceover at his studio, was a huge help. He gave me a lot of advice on how to do things. But that was a hard process too, because I wanted the music to be super loud and intense, but it would have to go right into a VO, right? And so like, how do you do that? How do you do that so that it sounds right? Like, how do we go from extreme loud, intense noise to an appropriate, correct level for vocals? Like, and doing it in a seamlessly beautiful way that doesn't distract the audience, you know? Like,
totally. And not just vocals, but like pretty soft, intimate vocals. Like you're yeah, softly reading us a right, heartfelt poem.
Right. That's a huge thing. The vocal. So, again, to reference Terrence Malick, Tree of Life and Thin Red Line, a lot of the words, a lot of the narration in those films, it's like the actor was talking to the mic. It's like the mic was like right here, like right next to their mouth. And they're talking like very, very quietly into the mic. And that's how you get that like close, intimate sound, that as if someone's like talking in your ear. Right. And I wanted to try to achieve that to a point. Which was a whole other experience, was like learning how, like, oh my gosh, like vocal recording is intense, dude. Like I've worked with a lot of music artists and like, you know, taken for granted, like, oh yeah, like she came out with a new album, like great. Like, dude, recording an album is like, I can't imagine, like, dude, like it's so hard. It's so exhausting using your voice and controlling your voice, voice control and making it consistent is an art form that's really impressive, dude. Really impressive. And it, like, as I was doing it, I was remembering, I'm like imagining, you know, Robin Williams in the intro scene to Mrs. Doubtfire when he's playing the cartoon and he said that, you know what I mean? Like, and I was imagining that. I'm like, dude, like, wow, he was so talented. Like, I've always admired Robin Williams, but like thinking back and like with the experience of doing my own sound recording, my gosh, like it just, as I was doing it, I was like, my God, these people are so outrageously talented. It makes sense how they, you know, they deserve everything they get.
Mm-hmm. Like, yeah,
you know, dude, sound recording your voice is just, it's incredibly difficult.
Totally. Totally. I mean, I know how hard it is to simply record a 1 minute intro for a podcast. And it's,
dude, yeah,
it's crazy. But the thing that really has been blowing my mind, it's cool to hear you, you know, share that, kind of thinking back on Robin Williams in that film and, you know, like voice acting is kind of hitting different for you. The thing that I have started to really deeply appreciate in the last 4 years doing the podcast is audiobooks and really good narrators that can like read dialogue and narration and like have different voices for each character and just switch seamlessly back and forth between them for like a 30-hour performance. I'm like, this is mind-blowing to me. Like, I want to know how they do that. I want to know if they like color code the book and like, how do they do that? It's incredible.
Yeah, I don't know. The most impressive one, honestly, I mean, and I assume they probably haven't re-recorded it because it's such a masterful creation, but like the audiobooks for the Harry Potter books are wild. I wish I could name the person. I don't remember who did it, but like the voice.
Is it Jim Dale or something like that?
Yeah, dude, actually, probably. Yeah. Dude, he's, I mean, that guy.
Yeah.
You want to produce a movie, you want to produce a cartoon, you hire that guy, he'll do every character. Totally. It's an incredible skill. And I mean, you know, by the end of my recording session, I was very humbled by what it takes. It's hard.
Well, you pulled it off. You did a great job. I thought, you sounded like, you know, you were right at home doing it. It sounded like something you had done many times, and your tone of voice really matched what you were saying, and the whole feeling of the film, it fit in there perfectly. So well done.
Thank you, man. I appreciate that. I'm glad that, yeah, thank you.
You know, I was considering asking you about camera equipment, why you shot with the Komodo, why you chose the Mavic 2 Zoom for the drone, but I don't know anything about cameras, and I want to kind of wrap up here soon. Tell me about the series of like behind the scenes videos that you're planning to do.
Yeah, totally. So, so I shot a bunch of behind the scenes content, which is essentially me on camera talking about different aspects of the film, in detail. We talked about camera equipment, talked about some of the stuff that we've talked about, location scouting, the soundtrack, what the post-production process was like, my creative direction for the movie, go into all these different subjects. And I plan to, now that the film is released, it released on mountainhardware.com. Now that it's out there, I'm planning to start releasing those. I'm going to release them on my film's website, sending.film, and I'll share them on Instagram as well. But yeah, we dive into as many different subjects about the film as I thought people may be interested to hear. And the reason I made that was because one aspect of this whole film for me was that it was essentially a practice run for me producing a movie, right? Because what I ultimately want to do in my career is produce narrative feature films, right? And that's what I'm trying to do right now with my friends. We're trying to make movies. And so for me, Sending was a test. It was like, okay, like, let's do the job of a film producer. Let's do every single step, right? Let's make a movie and get it into festivals, and let's promote it, and let's find sponsors for it, or let's find it, executive producers. Let's distribute it. Let's get it all done. And as I was making Sending, one type of commercial job that I was doing occasionally, I was shooting press kits for studio movies. Like, we were, you know, me and my friends, we would, you know, be multiple camera operators shooting press kits. You know, it's like Disney does this, all the studios do this. When they have a new movie coming out, they film the cast talking about the movie, right? And so that's a part of how they market and sell movies, and that's a thing. And so I realized, I'm like, okay, well, like, I'm not Disney, I'm not Warner Bros, so I don't have the ability to, you know, do it on that level, but I want to do what I can. I want to do my version of that. I want to try to like do that. So now I did that with Sending, and I'm excited to share that. I go in depth about the camera stuff. I mean, as much as I was trying to, you know, really be the director more so than the tech focused camera guy on this project, I definitely, you know, I love camera equipment, and the lenses and the cameras that we used were very deliberately chosen, and they were really important elements of what made the film what it ultimately is. For sure. Like, you couldn't have just, I mean, you know, every camera these days makes a good image, but you definitely could not have shot Sending with just any camera. Like, the Komodo was a pretty key decision. And I was working on a budget, man. I didn't have investors. I didn't have money. I was like trying to do this whole thing like on a shoestring by myself. And so, you know, it wasn't just like, okay, oh, let's go rent some Venices and let's go get a heavy lift drone and oh, let's get a techno crane. Like, it wasn't like that. It was like me and Shelby wearing F-stop backpacks with the cameras that we owned and like lenses that I got at a huge deal from my friend Ryan, who I'm really grateful for. And that was it.
Well, that's awesome. For people that want to, for aspiring filmmakers out there, and for people that just want to geek out and get behind the scenes with the film, those videos will start to become available at sending.film. You can also watch Sending there as well, and you can watch it on Mountain Hardware's website. I will link to all the places and all the things in the show notes for this episode, and I'll put a link to the film right there in your podcast app. Carlos, it's been great talking to you, man. I really appreciated it. What's next for you? What happens after this?
So right now, I do commercial video production. So I'm off shooting a doc right now, and I'm going to be continuing to work in narrative film. My friends and I have multiple feature films that we're trying to move into production. I'll say that, you know, making a movie is an insanely challenging thing to do. like making a music video and a commercial, those are hard too, but like trying to make a movie, oh my gosh, it's you're creating a company, you're creating a story, you're creating art, you're creating, it's so complicated. But we're committed to it, we're trying to do it, and so that's, you know, that's my next step in life, is really trying to make movies with my friends, and you know, see our work in theaters while they're still around.
That's awesome. Yeah, I can't wait to see what you create. Are any of these ideas related to climbing?
My next passion project is related to climbing. It's not going to be a climbing film, but it will have a climbing element to it. And I haven't even like formally written this thing out yet. So it's very much so an early phase concept at this point. But no, I mean, like when it comes to climbing, I'm going to be shooting climbing stuff similar to like shooting Anna doing To Bolt or Not To Be. Like that's the type of, you know, I want to shoot my friends climbing. I want to continue doing that just because it's fun and I love it. But doing something like Sending, I don't have anything else like Sending that I'm immediately going to do like within the next couple months. It's just, it, I mean, that project Sending took me like, yeah, I mean, I, you know, 4 years from like treatment writing to like release, you know? So it's, I'm not going to make another one of those immediately anytime soon, but, trying to make movies, man, I'm trying to make movies and climb. That's
nice.
What I'm doing.
I love it. That's awesome.
Yeah, man. Thank you for letting me do this. I appreciate it. You had some really fun, insightful questions, and, it means a lot to be able to ramble on about my movie, put a lot into it. So thank you. And also too, like, you know, I just want to say quickly, thank you to a few of the people who were super pivotal in the project, because I owe it to them. My friends, Doug, Max, Shelby, Ali, Ryan Broomberg. I mean, those guys, they all helped me in such unique ways, and without their help, I would not have been able to make this movie. So I'm like, I'm so grateful that they came and supported me. And then the sponsors, we got Hardware and Van Smith and Kaya and Touchstone. Like those companies really came in and helped me distribute the film in a way that a lot of other companies would not have given support. And I also didn't want to align the project with just any companies. I'm really proud that we were able to get support from them. They, you know, it feels good to be able to share this project with them. And so I'm grateful to you. I'm grateful to them. Thank you guys. Thank you everybody for making this thing a reality.
Well, it's my pleasure to have you, man. And thank you for bringing this thing to life. I know that any artistic project is a labor of love. Any passion project like this, it's just a total labor of love, but you've made something really beautiful. I really enjoyed it. I've watched it twice. I plan to watch it again. I plan to share it with my friends and sharing it with all my listeners. I urge you guys to go watch Sending. It's 20 minutes long. It's beautiful. It'll be a really nice change of pace for your busy day. I guarantee it. If you take 20 minutes to sit down and watch this, I think you'll feel refreshed as if you had been outside in the buttermilks for 20 minutes. It's a really lovely experience. What do you hope people take away from the film? That's my final question that I wanted to ask you before I let you go.
I hope people finish watching the film with an appreciation for how rich the climbing experience is beyond the individual accomplishments that we are trying to reach in climbing. You know, the film's called Sending because of everything that goes into sending. It's not just ticking another climb and posting it on Instagram and throwing the grade out there. You know, like that's not what, so much more to climbing that makes it an incredible, beautiful life experience to be able to have and share. And so, you know, I hope people that watch it just come away being able to appreciate just how stoked and fortunate and lucky we are to like have found this sport and this lifestyle, and, you know, go and enjoy it and use good technique and practice technique.
Go enjoy it and climb well, goddamn it.
Yeah, exactly. Well, thank you so much, man.
Beautiful.
Thank you.
My pleasure having you. Good luck on your film shoot.
Thank you, bro.
All right. Peace. Bye, everybody. Move with the rhythm. Shake it up, stop when the clock hits 13. Sing 1, 2, 3, 4. Cause, cause, cause.